connection with India goes back to when I was 10 years old. I went to India because my friend's father was working there. It was the first time I'd seen really visible poverty to that level. I found it quite shocking. There were some very, very beautiful things in India, particularly the architecture and art, and at the same time some very extreme poverty. That had a very strong effect on me. It was part of a series of events that made me want to devote my life to the spiritual life. I didn't think it was okay that children of my age were living on the streets and in that kind of visible poverty. So there was that, and then very much later I went on pilgrimage with the Order and Movement. Oh, and I also went on an international youth convention and the Order Convention in India. And, you know, got to know some of our Sangha in India and felt very, very inspired by the work that they do there and by the commitment that they have to the Dharma, to the extent of really making choices that were beyond just living a secure life. In India, there's no social security, there's no sort of safety net. And in a way, it echoed my own feelings that I didn't want to live a life purely for security. I wanted to live a life that made a difference to others. They had a lot of confidence that the Dharma really works and can make a difference to people's lives. I remember a story of Shakyanand, an Indian order member who's died, unfortunately. He made a vow that he would walk from village to village to spread the Dharma, no matter what cost it had to his health. There was something about that that really touched me, that someone would have so much faith in the efficacy of the Dharma. So he's a bit of a hero of mine, as are many of the Indian order members. Really, in India, the whole connection that people have with the Dharma is also in a social context. That comes from Dr. Ambedkar. They are Buddhists because of the example of Dr. Ambedkar, and Dr. Ambedkar had absolute confidence that actually what the world needs is the Dharma. Becoming Buddhists and practicing the Dharma would actually lead to social transformation, and that has proved to be the case as well. So looking at the figures for India, people who've converted to Buddhism and practice Buddhism have much better literature rates, who get an education and have better jobs. Even on that level, it works. But I think also going to India, and I remember being very, very struck by going to the big celebrations from the mass conversion to Buddhism. What I experienced in that Buddhist gathering of 2 million people, and it was quite late at night, I stayed there till quite late at night. In that gathering, there's never been any violence. The police have never been called. There's an extremely positive and harmonious atmosphere. There are young women and young men, completely free and easy relationships with each other. The stalls that were doing the most trade, as it were the stalls where the older students were teaching the younger students, helping them out with their studies and with career advice. It was so positive, and I thought, oh yes, this is what India could be like. This is a sort of mini Buddhist society. Traditionally, Indian society is divided into castes. The higher castes have all the power, basically. Traditionally, in that society, there's the four main castes, and then underneath that are what used to be known as the untouchables. So these are people who were deemed to be polluting just by their birth, and they would be known to be untouchable by any member of the higher castes. They were given the most menial roles, and still are in many places in India, dealing with carcasses of dead animals, dealing with human excrement, things like that. So they were given the most menial tasks, but in a way that was utterly degrading to keep them in their place. I know of someone from that community. He's an artist, and he was drawing depictions of stories he'd even recently heard, for example, of a man whose job it was to clear up the carcasses of dead dogs, having to carry them on his head. But this dog had been dead for maybe a week or something, and he put it on his head, and of course the carcass fell apart. So that said to me, well, it wasn't just being given a dirty job to do, but also, why would you not be given a wheelbarrow to do it? That's the history, and also there's been a lot of a history of violence against women from the scheduled caste, particularly as a means of social control. And then there's also control in terms of not giving people right to education or knowledge or land or even entry into the temples, so religious, spiritual life. So that's the history, and Dr. Ambedkar was from that community. He became, through a series of, through help from more liberal thinking Maharajas, actually. He got an education and became the most educated man in India. PhD from Columbia University in America and from London School of Economics in London. And he was called to the bar in Gray's Inn. So he was hugely successful, very, very hardworking, with a real passion of he had to help his people. He had to end inequality and particularly untouchability. And the caste system, he said, you know, he wanted to annihilate caste, which we shouldn't really think of as just caste. It's also annihilate inequality, because the way he went about doing that applies to inequality in all cultures. He tried legal means, which had been, you know, very helpful, and economic means and social protest, social action. In the end, he said, there has to be a transformation of heart and mind to remove inequality in the mind. That's why he decided that actually it had to be a religion. But he said that not all religions are worth having. Through careful thought and deliberation, he chose Buddhism, because Buddhism has a comprehensive system of morality. It removes inequality from the mind itself. There's so many aspects about who he was as a person. But, you know, he's one of the great social activists, and along with the great heroes of our society, like, you know, Nelson Mandela or people like that. And he's very little known, but actually he did such an enormous amount for other people and totally dedicated his life to that. He could have had a very, very easy life in America or the UK. He could have been a barrister or whatever he wanted to be. He just applied himself. So I think there's a lot we can take from the example of his dedication to inequality and removing inequality in society. I think there's also his confidence about Buddhism having a social aspect to it, that actually Buddhism is not just about our own lives. If we change our lives, it will also have an effect on society, and his confidence in that, and his confidence that to make the Buddha's teachings available to other people is a supreme act of generosity to the world. So he said, we mustn't think the duty of a Buddhist is to be a good Buddhist. We must see that our duty is to spread Buddhism, which is to serve mankind. And that can be a problematic message for the West, because we've got a history of quite cruel and unpleasant history of missionaries. You know, so as a society, we don't really favour the idea of spreading a religion. But actually, I think we could really reflect on what Dr. Ambedkar said and think to ourselves, well, actually, what would it be like if more people were Buddhists, and take some confidence in that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind, and whether keeping it as a private individual concern is enough. I remember talking to Sangharakshita at one point, and he said, well, one mustn't just look after one's own garden. And I was taking the garden to be one's mind. It's not enough just to tend to our own garden. We have to make that garden available to others. We have to help other people with their gardens. So there is a new Mitra Study module in Year 3 on Dr. Ambedkar, which I've put together, with help from Subhuti and Vajrasura particularly. What that seeks to do is, it uses as its basis Bhante's book, which is found in the Complete Works, Volume 9, which is Dr. Ambedkar and Buddhism. But it's also looking at Dr. Ambedkar's teachings, two of his very important papers. One of them is Annihilation of Caste, and the other is Buddha and the Future of His Religion. So it goes through Dr. Ambedkar's life and his sort of key thoughts, really, about how to transform society and how to remove inequality in society, and why Buddhism can take a central role in that, because it works directly on views, on the mind. Because inequality, as Dr. Ambedkar said, is not something that's physical and real. It's not a fence or a wall, or it's a state of mind, and how Buddhism can work to transform one's mind can remove inequality, not just in the mind, but in society as well. And it also has a week on it on Sangharakshita and Dr. Ambedkar, and why it is that the Triratna Buddhist order should be so popular amongst some of the followers of Ambedkar in India. Dr. Ambedkar unfortunately died months after his own public conversion to Buddhism, and a lot of his ideas about how Buddhism should be practiced in the modern world didn't have time to be developed. But one can see a kind of thread between his ideas of the Sangha and Sangharakshita, and in a way how the Triratna Buddhist order is in a good place, possibly the best place, to be able to offer the Dharma to people, to followers of Dr. Ambedkar in India. We're so lucky to have such an international movement and to have people from such different cultures involved with one order and movement, because we've got so much to learn from our Indian order members and movement because of their commitment to social change and Buddhism being a force for social change. But also the sort of faith and dignity that people have, they really see the value of the Dharma. And that, of course, you know, speaks to our own. We also know the value of the Dharma. And as Bhante said, when he was in communication with the Buddhists from India, he could see that actually our commitment to the Dharma was the same. I feel very, very lucky to have this connection to our Indian brothers and sisters through the India Dharma Trust. What we have is we've got a very wonderful problem. And the wonderful problem is that so many people are seeing the value of Buddhism in India, and they are wanting to embrace Buddhism and the Buddhist path. And they're wanting to do that in their hundreds. I've said this story a few times, but I'll say it again. There was some terrible caste atrocity in Gujarat. What had happened was some people from the scheduled caste had been publicly beaten in front of a police station and put in on videos on YouTube. I mean, really, really badly beaten and humiliated. In a way, why would you do that? Why would you beat someone in front of a police station and film it on YouTube? It's a sign to say, we don't care. You know, no one's going to touch us. The government isn't going to touch us and we can do what we like. One answer to that is to have a riot and the people from the scheduled caste community to get their own back. But they decided not to do that. They decided that they were going to embrace a path of peace and a path of social change and transformation of mind and heart. And they embraced Buddhism. So they came to Nagpur, and yeah, there were a few hundred who at that time, I think there'd be more since, who decided to become Buddhists. And it was such a joyful occasion, seeing those people so happy, so confident. And this is happening all over India. But of course, you know, as we know, Buddhism is a path of practice. It requires careful study and training, retreats, classes, workshops, all these things. And Kalyanamitrata, it requires spiritual friendship. So who is going to meet these people? They're embracing the Buddhism. They have that huge enthusiasm for the Dharma. Who's going to respond to that? What the India Dharma Trust does is it raises money outside of India, so that's in the UK and Europe and Australasia and the Americas, to help. Well, basically, we give it to the Indian public preceptors and say, how would you like to spend this? The majority is spent on Dharma workers, you know, not on buildings or equipment and all these sort of things. It's actually spent on people's wages so that they can devote themselves full time to going to meet people who've converted to Buddhism, run retreats, run workshops, and help them train in Buddhism to the level at which they're ready for ordination, and then they can do the same. So that's what we do. It used to be that Dharma work was funded by Karuna, but Karuna Trust felt that they couldn't, rightly so, they couldn't really use money that they'd raised from non-Buddhist to spend on Buddhist projects. In a way, it has to come from people who know the value of Buddhism. The Karuna Trust does social projects, but in a way, the India Dharma Trust is trying to look at the root of the inequality, and it gives rise to the need for social projects and help people practice the Dharma. In terms of people actually training for ordination, to put it into context, I know particularly about the women's side because I'm involved with ordination training in the West. You've got 1,000 women who are training for ordination outside of India. In India, you've got about 1,000 women training for ordination. So I assume it's similar on the men's side. So it's about 2,000 people. To put that into context, in the women's wing, we've got about 70 private preceptors, women private preceptors, to help those 1,000 women training for ordination. In India, we've got 6. You know, it would be good to have more full-time workers who can free themselves up from a lot of other responsibilities and actually just give themselves to the Dharma. With the India Dharma Trust, it's a real opportunity to feel part of what's happening in India. And that's what we'd like to do at the India Dharma Trust. It's about raising money, but it's also about raising awareness and a sense of one order and one sangha, where people feel a part of each other's lives because we can benefit so much from each other and what we've got in common in terms of our aspirations and commitment and faith in the Dharma, but also how our lives are different. I think my life is so enriched by having contact with the Indian Sangha. I can't imagine my Buddhist practice without it, in a sense. It's really become part of me. And it makes me very, very happy.